You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in. Hour two of the Mike Allen Show. Best yet to come. Hope the same is true of your week. It's a Monday, right? So nowhere to go but up, the way I look at it. Anyway, next segment, I'll be talking to Rick Becker. Rick Becker, who has been a guest several times on the program now. He has his own blog, God Haunted Lunatic. I encourage you to check it out. I'll put a link to that on the show's Facebook page. But today's article, coming from the National Catholic Register, which he's written, called Convert Companions of Merton and Waugh, Me and You. Rick Becker writing about a recent book that detailed some of the correspondence between the great British novelist Evelyn Waugh, author of Brideshead Revisited, and Thomas Merton, his American pen pal. Thomas Merton, of course, the Trappist monk and priest who wrote the remarkable spiritual autobiography, Seven Story Mountain, this book by Mary Frances Cody, Merton and Waugh, a monk, a crusty old man, and the Seven Story Mountain, Rick has read. And we'll talk some about that and what it can teach us in terms of conversion, in terms of friendship, conversation. And I'm asking a question of the day related to that as well. It seems almost anachronistic to talk about handwritten letters, mailing them, being pen pals, all the rest, in our days of email, text, Skype, social media, all the rest. So I'm asking a question of the day. Do you still send handwritten letters? And if so, how often would you say? And to whom, primarily? 573-4BREAD-4. You can chime in with a call or a text anytime during the program. 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. You can post your response on Facebook or Twitter. I need another sip of coffee. My Breadbox Media stainless steel coffee cup, keeping my coffee warm this morning. If I just had a donut to go with it, I'd be all right, even though I got plenty in my house. Somebody, for some reason, yesterday, actually, they've done it a couple days in a row. Actually, they bring them by for the youth group. For my wife, they have these leftover donuts, and they're really, it's just kind of homemade donuts at this shop here in Lexington where we broadcast from. And this person has had some leftover donuts they brought by for the youth group yesterday. I came home with three boxes of these donuts sitting on top of my kitchen table. Temptation. Get thee behind me, Satan. See, donuts for me are like Pringles. If I have one, all bets are off. And that's what happened with me last night. Just one donut. One cinnamon donut. What could it hurt? Three donuts later, my stomach is stuffed. Let's just put it this way. And I'm thinking, you eat those donuts, they don't even seem like anything until about 10 minutes later. And then you're thinking, what have I done? I was in full Homer Simpson donuts mode. So anyway, but I got my coffee. No donuts this morning. Got to do better. It's a new week. 573-4BREAD-4. Today, the memorial of the martyrdom of St. John the Baptist, the Passion of St. John the Baptist, as it's termed by the USCCB, historically known as the Beheading of St. John the Baptist, or title a little less graphic than that. But as we've talked about in the last hour, if you look at today's reading from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 6, it tells the story. It's quite a dramatic one about Herod, who had arrested John the Baptist because of his relentless challenge to the validity of his marriage to his wife Herodias, who had been his brother's wife, and his brother still alive. Herod, as I said, liked to claim his Jewish identity when it best served him, but John would have none of it and continued to relentlessly preach against the unlawfulness of his marriage. His wife Herodias hated John, wanted him dead, but Herod feared John, knowing him to be a righteous and holy man, and kept him in custody. As I said, this This is a story that doesn't just tell what happened, but what always happens. And that those in power, even though they have all weapons and artillery at their disposal, they have a moral fear. They have a moral fear of truth and of the one who stands in righteousness, even though he himself equipped with no weapons. You think about the almost paranoid fanaticism out of Soviet bloc communism, their fear of John Paul II, even though Stalin mockingly could say back in the day regarding the papacy, how many divisions has the Pope? When the time came for John Paul II, the Polish Pope, the first non-Italian in 500 years, to return and make a papal visit to Poland, then locked down tight under the claw of Soviet communism, there was such paranoia and fear among the Soviets, even, and I don't know whether it's been officially proven, their involvement in the attempted assassination on the Pope. Why were they concerned with all the weaponry, with the nuclear arsenal at their behest? Why in the world be concerned about a celibate older man dressed in white with no military behind him because of his moral authority? When those who are in authority know they have no moral authority, they tend to fear the one who does. And you, by the way, just as an aside, Herod's paranoia about John would even show up later after he beheads John. And he thinks that Jesus is John the Baptist risen from the dead. He was so freaked out by John, even when he beheaded him, he didn't sleep well. Anyway, of course, how the whole story plays out, you have Herod on his birthday, the only, I think, birthday party recorded in sacred scripture. On his birthday, he gave a banquet. Herodias sent her daughter, Herod's own stepdaughter, in to perform a dance that delighted Herod and his guests. And I don't think she was doing the Dougie, if you know what I mean. After she performed the dance before her stepfather, the king said to the girl, "Ask of me whatever you wish, and I will grant it to you." He even swore many things to her. "I will grant you whatever you ask of me, even a half of my kingdom." I'm sure there was a little alcohol flowing as well. She went out and said to her mother, "What shall I ask for?" She replied, "The head of John the Baptist." And so the girl hurried back to the king's presence and made her request, "I want you to give me at once on a platter the head of John the Baptist." But the king was distressed because of his oaths and guests. He did not wish to break his word to her. So he dispatched an executioner who went off and brought back the head of John the Baptist. He brought the head on the platter, gave it to the girl. The girl in turn gave it to her mother. When the disciples heard about it, they came and took his body and laid it in a tomb. And I believe there's actually a claimed that someone has the head or the skull of St. John the Baptist, maybe lost a couple of times. I can't remember where currently it is venerated. But again, how things always happen. The moral authority of the prophet sought to be silenced by violence. Now, here's the thing, right? Because when, as I said, the story of the martyrdom of St. John the Baptist, much like so much in Scripture, which becomes almost a schema or some sort of a prototype of not just how things happened, but how things always happen. Look throughout the course of human history. Persons who, in many ways, reflect the image of John the Baptist. St. Thomas More, for example, killed St. John Fisher. Killed because they were not willing, like everyone else, it seems, simply to turn a blind eye. And that great line from the film, A Man for All Seasons, as the cardinal says to St. Thomas More, the cardinal who had long since sold out, Cardinal Wolsey, to Henry VIII, he says, "You're a constant regret to me, Thomas. If you could just see facts straight on without that horrible moral squint." Well, when you read the first reading today, which is taken from 1 Corinthians 2, St. Paul's letter to the church in Corinth, "When I came to you, brothers and sisters, proclaiming the mystery of God, I did not come with sublimity of words or of wisdom, for I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness and fear and much trembling, and my message and my proclamation were not with persuasive words of wisdom, but with a demonstration of spirit and power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on the power of God. Now, it's interesting, the juxtaposition of a Pauline letter or epistle, talking about handwritten letters, and the gospel today. Because St. Paul, like St. John the Baptist, the predecessor, the forerunner of the Messiah, St. Paul would also die via beheading, bearing within himself not only the message of Christ crucified, but even in his body. See, here's the thing, right? St. John the Baptist, the last of the prophets, the age of the prophets, the Old Testament prophets, would end with John the Baptist. This is what Jesus would say. He's the greatest born of woman, yet who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. He was the last of the Old Testament prophets. The prophets, as we've said before, oftentimes bore in their very bodies the message. Constant object lessons incarnating in their bodies. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, read it. Isaiah, asked to walk around naked as a sign. John the Baptist bearing, in a sense, Christ crucified in his very body. St. Paul doing the same. And guess what, friends? You and I, through our baptism, we share in Christ's office as priest, prophet, and king. We may have to bear in our own bodies the crucified Lord. Are we willing? St. John the Baptist, all you holy men and women, pray for us that we may not faint or grow weary. We'll be back with Rick Becker. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on the 29th of August, this Monday, the feast day of the Passion of St. John the Baptist. I'm pleased to have on the program Rick Becker. Rick, coming from Mishawaka, Indiana, where he teaches nursing there at Bethel College. He's a convert to Catholicism by way of G.K. Chesterton and the Catholic Worker Movement, with a particular interest in ecumenism. Has studied theology at evangelical Protestant institutions, as well as Franciscan University of Steubenville, the father of seven. He resides with his family in South Bend, Indiana, where he and his wife Nancy serve as co-directors of religious education at St. Matthew Cathedral. As I said, he's a registered nurse, teaches nursing there at Bethel College. He has an excellent blog entitled God Haunted Lunatic. He also writes for the National Catholic Register, where this article about that we're going to discuss today appears. Good morning, Rick.
Morning, Mike.
So we were talking a little bit off air, moved a couple of your kids in there at the Golden Dome recently.
That's right. I have a junior there. Actually, my junior is going to be traveling to Dublin this fall, but he's studying engineering, and then my daughter is a sophomore, is studying all humanities and Shakespeare and medieval studies. So when they get to Notre Dame, when they're there together, they never see each other.
Well, you'll be glad to know I had a guy on the show last week from who's a philosophy professor at the University of St. Thomas, and he was talking about God's providence and how, you know, sometimes, you know, we can actually pray to God to be behind our side, and so that it was even okay to pray for your sports team to win as long as you're docile about whether God answers that prayer. So, hey, touchdown Jesus, you know.
That's
pray,
right.
Pray for the Irish.
That's right. That's right.
Has to be true if you hear it on the radio.
Yeah, hey, that's absolutely right.
So anyway, I really loved the column here about, you really were writing about a book that you discovered called Merton and Waugh, subtitled A Monk, A Crusty Old Man in the Seven-Story Mountain. It was something I didn't realize, the pen pal type of relationship that developed between the British novelist Evelyn Waugh and Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk and priest. One an American, of course, one a Brit. But I guess Merton was born in Great Britain, so they
That's
had that
right.
in common. But
he studied at Cambridge.
Both converts to the faith, but it sounded like a fascinating read.
It was. I was delighted to stumble across it because of a number of connections for me personally. Evelyn Waugh's, much of his writing, but especially his great novel, Brideshead Revisited, is a story of... It's about upper-class British society and romance and sin and salvation. I think I even mentioned that in my piece. But it's really a story about conversion. And it was instrumental in my own conversion, that image, those ideas of struggling with faith and truth and then surrender. And I know that the students, the people that I've passed it along to, it's been instrumental in their lives as well. And then Merton. I was thinking about this as I was driving into work this morning. Merton was the Scott Hahn of his generation. And his book, Seven Story Mountain, which described his own conversion to Catholicism and then his desire, his decision to become a Trappist monk, influenced untold numbers of Catholics or converts in the West. People read his story and were inspired to investigate not just Catholicism, but even monasticism. So both of them were instrumental. His particular story was not his autobiography, Seven Story Mountain, wasn't influential on my own conversion, but I've read many of his books on spirituality and prayer. And I've had a chance to visit Gethsemane a couple of times, once with my son, actually, my son who's a junior at Notre Dame. And it's a holy place, and Merton's not the only reason that Gethsemane is an important center for spiritual renewal and prayer.
As I told you, I'm embarrassed that I've not been there, and I need to make it my way over because it's only maybe a little over an hour drive here from where we're broadcasting from. Seven Story Mountain, an amazing book, and Brideshead Revisited, one of those books that I keep telling myself to read. I've got it sitting on my shelf, and I just haven't done it. You know, one of the things that I found a little interesting, too, was these weren't letters between the two of them that were just full of platitudes and bromides. I mean, they challenged each other, didn't they?
They did, and the original reason for the correspondence had to do with Merton's. Merton was a fledgling writer. In fact, he didn't want to write when he got into the monastery. My understanding is that the abbot knew that he had some writing experience, had some success with writing before he became a Catholic back in England, basically, under obedience, Merton started to write again and was interested in trying to be a better writer. And he turned to Waugh, who at that point had published widely, had been very successful novelist. And their correspondence originally kind of revolved around Merton's interest in getting some mentoring for his own writing. It's not surprising that it turned into more than that. And as you said, Merton became, he was a mentor, Waugh was a mentor for Merton in terms of writing in particular, but then Merton became a spiritual mentor of sorts through their correspondence to Evelyn Waugh. And you might know this about Waugh, but towards the end of his life, especially after Vatican II, Evelyn Waugh became quite discouraged in his faith. He didn't like the changes that had happened after Vatican II. I don't know if you would say he approached even a certain a kind of despair. But I think the correspondence with Merton was very helpful to him to rejuvenate, at least during that time when they did correspond, rejuvenate his faith. And it was a very fruitful relationship. And, you know, it makes me think, this is a digression, but in this age in which all of our correspondence these days is electronic and is not preserved, at least not in a physical form, the fact that these physical letters
yes.
exist and the author was Mary Frances Cody, was able to refer to them as... that's something we've lost today.
Yeah,
but
it's
anyway, that's a digression.
Has a bit of an anachronistic feel, the whole idea of writing letters. We just don't do it anymore, and certainly the kind of correspondence that is very thoughtful and reflective, and we've become such a soundbite culture. We don't even like to talk on the phone. We prefer texting, whereas these were thoughtful men who were not afraid to speak what they saw as truth to each other, too.
Right, and an investment of time. I know you didn't want to you didn't call me to talk about
no, actually, writing,
but
I actually
it
made
is
that
an
by
exercise. It's a sacrifice to sit down, to set aside the time to write a thoughtful letter instead of whipping out a three lines of an email or a text. And it is a gift to write to sit down and to compose a thoughtful letter, I think. I'm certainly, now that my kids are going off to college, I've got two at Notre Dame, as I said. I'll have one in Ireland this fall, and I've a third child now down at Purdue, that I am going to make a point of sitting down and writing out letters to send to them so that they have those physical representations of my love.
It's not it's not a side road at all, Rick, because I actually ended up making that my question of the day, of asking people if they still send handwritten letters, and if so, how often and to whom. Back to the actual book of correspondence between the two. It's interesting because the Catholic Herald had a review of this book, and their headline was, and I know writers don't choose headlines, but it said, "Why Evelyn Waugh wanted Thomas Merton to shut up." It was, Waugh was, favored conciseness, in writing, tight writing, and Merton was more loquacious, I guess, verbose and so forth. And of course,
right.
Waugh, the story famously told that someone said to him one time they couldn't believe he was Catholic because of how big a jerk he was, and he said something along the lines, "You have no idea how much bigger a jerk I'd be if I wasn't Catholic." So
yeah, that's right. That's right.
He was a crusty man.
He was. He was a curmudgeon, to be sure, and curmudgeons have a place in the church. I always think of St. Jerome, I think, as a patron saint of curmudgeons like Evelyn Waugh, perhaps, who had a crusty, St. Jerome had a crusty side himself. But getting back to your point about the writing, I think I mentioned in the article that I wrote that I first stumbled across this book because of a quotation that was lifted from the book and was put in the Wall Street Journal, and I actually cut out that. I have it here right in front of me. I cut it out and put it above my desk because it was such a, as a fledgling writer myself, it was such a punchy bit of wisdom from an expert writer that I just had to have it before me all the time. And with reference to what you said about Merton being a little bit too wordy, he says in this little pullout quote, it says, "Examine each sentence and ask, does this say precisely what I mean?" And then he talks about eliminating words. It's very much like Strunk and White's advice to writers, but it's done with with Waugh's flair, of course, the friendship.
Rick, we're out of time for this break. We're going to have a segment. We'll have to pick it up on the other side of the break, and we'll
okay.
talk about also how Dorothy Day makes an appearance here. So we'll be back in just a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Mm-hmm. We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show. Here with the writer and blogger. Check it out, God Haunted Lunatic, Rick Becker's work, godhauntedlunatic.wordpress.com. I'll put a link to it on the show's Facebook page. He also writes for the National Catholic Register in his spare time, along with teaching nursing at Bethel College there in Mishawaka, Indiana, and parenting seven children along with his wife. So I'm glad to have Rick Becker here. We've been talking about a piece he has in the National Catholic Register, really a review of sorts of a book by Mary Frances Cody, comprised of the letters between Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk and priest and famous Catholic convert, and Evelyn Waugh, also a convert, British novelist, author of Brideshead Revisited. Merton and Waugh, a monk, a crusty old man, and the seven-story mountain. Rick, thanks for holding on.
Of course. Thanks, Mike.
As you point out in the article, not only Merton and Waugh, famous Catholics appearing in the book, but others, including Dorothy Day, who had a significant influence in your own conversion, shows up.
That's true. There's an incident that Mary Frances Cody relates in the book involving Evelyn Waugh's swing to the United States. He made two trips to the United States, one of which was when he visited Thomas Merton. The only time they actually met in person was that first swing to the United States, kind of a lecture tour and a preparation for an article he wrote about American Catholicism for, I think, Life magazine. But anyway, while he was on that tour, his spiritual director back in England urged him to get to know Dorothy Day and visit the Catholic Worker, which at the time was still on Mott Street in New York City. It was what I think one of the earlier locations before they moved around. It was in the Depression in the 30s. And it must have been, I think in my article I said there was a delicious irony, the juxtaposition between this high society writer, socialite from England, Evelyn Waugh, showing up in basically a limo in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and people lining up in the bread line, the soup line outside of the Catholic Worker. Must have been memorable. I'm sure many people cherish that memory, people who were there when they saw it. But he met Dorothy Day. He wanted to take her and all the Catholic workers out to a fancy restaurant to eat, and Dorothy demurred and said no, that wouldn't be appropriate. And so they went to a neighborhood Italian eatery and shared a meal together. And apparently, Waugh was very generous in the libations as well, much to Dorothy's chagrin. But there too, just like the affection that you see in the letters between Merton and Waugh, you pick up on, even in that brief meeting, there developed an affection. And Dorothy Day herself was a convert. I think you mentioned that in your intro. There was an affection that developed between Waugh and Dorothy Day to the extent that Dorothy testifies to the fact that Waugh would send her checks from time to time from England after he returned to the UK. And even though he didn't agree with all of her her work and how she did it, and some of the positions that she took, I would imagine, especially with regards to pacifism, but that he did support her in her her works of mercy, the care of the poor. And then the reverse is true as well. You can pick up in Dorothy's writings where she talks about this incident in Loaves and Fishes, in her book Loaves and Fishes, which is a follow-up to Long Loneliness. She writes about Waugh with a certain amount of, I can picture her with a little smile as she remembers that incident with the limo pulling up in front of the worker. But I think it part of the I met the piece that I wrote, the one that you read in the Register, I titled Convert Companions, because I think that relationship between Waugh as a convert and Dorothy Day as a convert, and then Waugh and Merton as well as converts, that's an illustration of the kind of mutual support that, and this is true for many things, of course, but I think particularly for Roman Catholic converts, you do enter into a strange and foreign world, especially these days. Catholicism is itself, by definition, countercultural, but in our current context, I think, is pointedly countercultural. So once you would make the decision to embrace Catholicism and try to acclimate yourself to this countercultural foreign realm, it's essential that we have people to accompany us, people, especially people who understand it, who get it. And I think that the three of them were that for each other. And it's why converts not only turn, people who join the church not only read converts, people like Chesterton and Merton and Waugh and Dorothy Day, but we rely on their writings to accompany us as we try to figure it out.
Well, you know, the Catholic Church is a big place, right? So, as Chesterton said, it's a lot bigger from the inside than it is from the outside, and you realize that we all come into it from various perspectives, and we all have our own particular points of where we need refining and further conversion, and maybe a good image of this book and this correspondence and this exchange too between Waugh and Day is that we need each other to refine away to our sin and our rough edges, and sometimes we can see those in others, maybe in each other, more than we can see that see it in ourselves, and so we need each other and that accountability that comes, because I was thinking about Waugh and Merton, just like Waugh became frustrated with Merton's excesses verbally.
Right.
Perhaps Merton became frustrated, and Day to Waugh's excesses in other ways.
that's true. That's true. And I think it's also unlike what you described. I think that's a beautiful image. That God uses people, and it's that image of iron sharpening iron from Scripture that God uses. God makes use of our friendships and our relationships with others to help iron out our wrinkles and smooth our rough edges, and of course that's the essence of marriage. But marriage is a permanent relationship, and with regards to Merton and Waugh, it seems that their correspondence and their long distance friendship kind of petered out over time, especially as Merton became more confident in his own writing skills and was less reliant on Waugh's advice. And I think Waugh, for whatever reason, their relationship just kind of, as far as the correspondence is concerned, petered out. But it's almost that too is I think important to remember that in those kinds of friendships, God brings people into our lives. He orchestrates events that the people that are around us, the people that come in and out of our lives, might be for a long time. It might be a short time, but those are the people that God is going to use to smooth our rough edges for whatever season, however long that season lasts. And to always be mindful, I think their correspondence that was very intense for a little while, and then, as I said, it kind of waned, is a reminder to us too that we want to be as supple as possible with regards to God using us in the lives of those around us.
No matter how long. I can't help but think of that verse from Proverbs: "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful." I think so many times we don't want to, in our friendships, be willing to push beyond the surface to where we really can, in charity, both be challenged by our friends and to challenge them in a way that really, God in His providence has brought us together. You have a great quote here, or you talk about being beneficiaries of each other's efforts in the order of grace, and you have a quote here from Dom Hubert van Zeller. All these things so mixed up in us, so cut across by what we've learned from others, from experience, from our surroundings, and from the 101 apparently fortuitous circumstances of every day have fitted into the pattern, which is me.
Right. Yes, it's a beautiful quote. It's a beautiful quote. And I do the anonymity, ignorance, really, of how God is using us in the lives of others, of course, is important as well. If I always tell my students, my nursing students, it's a mercy that God doesn't let us see how important our incidental contributions to the lives of others, how important those things are, because if we did see them, we would be tempted to pride, to a pride that would be, detrimental to our spiritual well-being. I mean, we have no idea how we influence people's lives. The things that we think are important the things that we might take pride in are probably not the most important things. It's probably the things that we have no idea. And I'm sure you've experienced that yourself, where people have come back to you and said something you said on the radio that you would never remember, or something that you did, a gesture, and how important it was to them.
Sometimes it may be in a handwritten letter that we send to that someone saves. Rick, we're out of time. Always a pleasure, and I hope you have a great week. New semester starting, both for you and for your kids. Blessings to you and your family.
I look forward to talking to you again.
All right, Rick, definitely. We'll be back in just a minute with more. We'll spin the Dollar Catechism wheel. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back into the Mike Allen Show here on this beautiful Monday, the feast day of the Passion of St. John the Baptist. I just posted a link on the show's Facebook page to Rick Becker's blog. I had already put a link on there to the article that we discussed about Evelyn Waugh and Thomas Merton, but I want you to check out his blog too, God Haunted Lunatic. Rick Becker, a very thoughtful, very profound, thinker in terms of his Catholic faith and really the whole spectrum of Catholic moral teaching, social teaching, the beauty of it all, and very well-read. I like to pretend that I'm well-read, much like George Costanza always wanted to pretend to be an architect. Rick Becker actually is, and it challenges me. I've got laying around a copy of the book by Evelyn Waugh, Brideshead Revisited. I just haven't read it yet. I did read Seven Story Mountain, but have not been to Gethsemane either. And I want to read The Long Loneliness by Dorothy Day. But, what a big tent church that we have in many ways. I mean, you've got somebody like Waugh on the one side. He was telling me, Rick was telling me after we finished there, he's up there in the vicinity of Notre Dame, two students there under the Golden Dome, two of his kids. He was saying that in the book, it tells the story of one of Waugh's two tours to the U.S. He went by Notre Dame and complained that they only served tea and coffee in the cafeteria. I thought they should serve wine there. So I said, if he criticized Merton for his verbal excesses, Merton could challenge Waugh on his excess of, let's say, the drink. Anyway, pretty fascinating stuff. A big, beautiful church that we're part of with a whole lot of different perspectives, but God's holding us all together by His grace. 573-4BREAD-4, asking a question of the day about writing letters. Do you still write or send handwritten letters? And if so, how often and to whom do you send them? 573-4BREAD-4. Nuns and habits have been in the news lately. Certainly the situation in Nice over in France, site of the horrible terrorist attack, the truck driven through the crowd there on Bastille Day, and I guess the predictable reaction from the French authorities of the almost a paranoia. You know, of course, first you had the banning of the burqa. Now you've got the whole story we talked about last week of the banning of the burkini, which is kind of a slang term, I guess, for a swimming garment that covers the entire person, used by Muslim women, and how the burkini somehow has been banned from the beaches at Nice. And there was the story last week caught on camera, actually, of some authorities forcing a Muslim woman there sleeping peacefully on the beach to disrobe from her burkini. And there have been a lot of people, of course, highly critical of that. And the deputy mayor of Nice doubling down. This a piece here from the Catholic Herald. The deputy mayor of Nice has said that nuns wearing habits are no more welcome on his beaches than women wearing burkinis. Speaking to presenter Edward Storton on The World at One on BBC Radio, the deputy mayor, Rudy Salas, defended the burkini ban and said, "What is the burkini? There is a bikini and there is burqa, and the burqa is forbidden. When you go to the beach, you wear a bathing suit. You don't go to the beach as you want. If I want to go on the beach naked, it's forbidden. I cannot. So if you want to go to the beach in a burkini, it's forbidden because it's a provocation. Religion and the state are completely separated." Religion, here's a kind of a chilling thing that the deputy mayor of Nice said. "Religion is the affair of each one, but each one at home, each one at church, not each one in the street." Sort of reminiscent of the whole freedom of worship phrase that was being bandied around a lot by the current presidential administration here, and was seen early on as a signal of a really reduction of the idea of religious freedom. Religious freedom means the freedom to live my faith out in the world, not simply in private. I mean, having that level of freedom of worship you have in Saudi Arabia, because nobody can invade the citadel of your own heart. When Edward Storton, the interviewer, asked the deputy mayor, "What about a Catholic nun? Would she be allowed to appear on the beach wearing her habit?" And this is in a country with such a rich Catholic tradition. I mean, St. Therese of Lisieux, hello? Anyone? So he asks the deputy mayor, "What about a Catholic nun? Would she be allowed to appear on the beach wearing her habit?" The deputy mayor replied, "No. The same." Wow. Again, here is where we let our fears, and believe me, I can't even imagine what the people of Nice have been through and are going through. But when we let our fears cause us to give up the very things that make us who we are as a free society, the freedom not only to not wear a burkini, but the freedom to wear a burkini, the freedom to wear a habit. It's interesting. It's almost a delicious irony, really, that now there are many, because of the burkini ban and this horrible scene of making a Muslim woman disrobe, that you're seeing now secular feminists who are defending the burkini and, I guess, by extension, defending the religious habit, not as a sign of oppression, but as a sign of freely chosen religious expression. Now, where else are habits in the news? Well, you know, you've had this horrible story, and eternal rest grant unto them, O Lord, and let perpetual light shine upon them. These two religious sisters murdered in Mississippi, in their homes. They've caught the killer. Brutal crime scene. It's just unimaginable. These two women who have given their lives in consecration, in vows, evangelical vows, poverty, chastity, obedience, in service and as witness, and they've had their lives brutally taken from them. How long, O Lord, how long? And I saw someone had posted yesterday on Facebook about this, the story of the man being killer, or the killer being captured. And I saw, and there was, of course, a picture of the two religious sisters, non-habited nuns. So after the Second Vatican Council, there were some religious orders that set aside their exterior habit. And it's, you know, of course, causes some conflict and controversy among Catholics about the propriety of not wearing a habit, wearing a habit, whatever, just as there is with the clergy, not wearing a collar, wearing the collar, and so forth. But anyway, a Facebook commenter on this story that was posted on my friend's Facebook page said this: I wonder if he knew they were nuns and if he would have killed them if they were wearing habits. And I read that and my heart just sunk. I thought, really? Are we now, have our Catholic, you know, inter-Catholic culture wars become such that we're going to blame these two sisters for their own murder because they weren't wearing habits? Really? I mean, is that how petty we've become? God help us. God help us. That is, man, there's an ugliness there in a comment like that. But I will say, I mean, we've, I guess, all been guilty of it in one way or another, the way that we evaluate who's really Catholic and who's really not. I'm not saying there aren't legitimate issues of dispute. There are, certainly. There are non-negotiables to the Catholic faith, but there are other things. A friend of mine calls it sort of competitive orthodoxy, where I'm more Catholic than thou or whatever, even though it's an issue where there can be a legitimate disagreement, because we've already talked about with Evelyn Wall, with Thomas Merton, with Dorothy Day, there are a lot of different ways to be Catholic. Don't blame these sisters for their own death. Pray for the repose of their soul and that somehow God might use in some way, bring some redemptive work in the life of the killer and others in whom they served through their very unjust death. Let's spin the dial of catechism wheel. Let's go to random.org. We've got a couple minutes left here. We'll spin up a number between 1 and 2865. Total number of paragraphs in the catechism. We'll see what Providence has in store for us, knowing, of course, that truth is never random, but always integrated within the panoramic totality of the faith. 2101 is the number. 2101. We're almost there. Aha, this is, how about this? This is in Promises and Vows. We've just talked about religious persons, those religious sisters who've made vows. Well, we all make promises and vows. It's under the third pillar of the Catechism, Life in Christ. In many circumstances, the Christian is called to make promises to God. Baptism and confirmation, matrimony and holy orders always entail promises. Out of personal devotion, the Christian may also promise to God this action, that prayer, this almsgiving, that pilgrimage, and so forth. Fidelity to promises made to God is a sign of the respect owed to the divine majesty and the love of for a faithful God. Promises are, by their very nature, by the way, an expression of love. It's really what they are. When a couple makes promises at the altar, it's not because they are somehow bound from without. They're bound from within because, as G.K. Chesterton, we mentioned him earlier, liked to say, it is the nature of love to bind itself. Love can never be free in terms of unattached, but love by its very nature binds itself. Our Lord, in His love, has bound Himself to us through His ultimate promise, His vow, covenant love on the cross. We'll be back tomorrow by God's grace. This is The Mike Allen Show.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.